Please be seated. Well, this past Monday, I was at a local medical clinic getting an allergy shot. It was work, by the way. At least for me, they have. I used to be flat out in April and May, and 3 years ago, I started getting these shots, and maybe it's just I'm getting older, not as, you know, reactive to the environment, but they seem to be working. Anyway, I was chatting to the nurse about the beautiful weather, and just getting out and enjoying it. And we both agreed that it would be a shame not to, and yet how guilty many of us feel for doing just that, for not getting out and enjoying it. Shouldn't we be working harder, being more practical, more efficient with our time? We agreed that the almost blasé word balance was what we were looking for, and we laughed, and I said, well, see you next month, and she said, you bet, and that was that. It was time for her to administer her next cure. It was time for me to get practical, get to that coffee shop and answer emails, work on a bulletin, and begin to pen these words. Efficiency, practicality, meanwhile, outside, the sun shone gloriously. Those of you that get to work outside, you know, you're lucky. I'm sure this type of conversation is common enough. Possibly most of us have been introduced or have been involved in such a conversation so many times that we can hardly remember the last time we had it. But underneath its ordinariness, there is a kind of niggling feeling, a wondering, maybe even a fear. What's an ordinary life supposed to look like? Am I missing out on something important? You know, FOMO, fear of missing out, is a thing I hear for those of you that are socially into the social media. Or maybe even more importantly, this question. What might it mean to live an ordinary life in an extraordinary way? Is that a contradiction? The texts given to us this week, at least the ones from the New Testament, give us some hope that these sorts of questions are being actually addressed in Jesus' ministry, and therefore might provide some light for us. The story given to us by John, set 1 week before Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem and 2 weeks before his death, which is why the lectionary editors have us read it a week before Holy Week begins, is in many ways a quintessential gospel story. It's centered around a meal and around unhurried conversation. Things that may strike us as quite ordinary, something that you and I experience. Well, actually, maybe not so much in the modern world, right? A meal in a house, an unhurried conversation. Get with the times, man. It's screaming in a pub while eating overpriced appies and beer. No, you get the point. It's probably something we still do, thankfully, get to enjoy. A meal in a house, unhurried conversation, at least from time to time. As an aside, of course, the reason we celebrate Eucharist, the central act of Christian worship, is not just because Jesus commanded us to at the Last Supper. Actually, Jesus commanded us to at the Last Supper because that sort of thing was what he did. It was what he did in his ministry, whether it was healing or conversation or teaching. It was often set around food. Now, of course, what the Gospels do so dramatically and convincingly is combine these ordinary elements with the extraordinary. And by extraordinary, I don't just mean what Jesus does in these settings, like turning an afternoon picnic into the feeding of the 5,000, but the extravagant acts of commitment by those who experience him. So famously, in Matthew's gospel, the fraudster, remember this guy, Little Zacchaeus, which is not his rap handle, but the fact that he was little, makes the announcement at the supper table that if he's ripped anybody off, yeah, he's ripped people off big time, he'll pay them back fourfold. And here we have this extraordinary scene of Mary pouring out a perfume so expensive that it would have taken an average laborer a full year to pay for it. That is extravagance, extraordinariness defined. Why? Because she's so deeply grateful that Jesus raised her brother Lazarus from the dead. I was reading some anecdotes from surgeons who tell of parents showing up at the hospital, gifts in hand, after the life-saving operation for a child. So there's a psychological realism in this scene, even as we understand how momentous and strange it is. Here, the act of extravagant gratefulness sets up the conflict in the story. A conflict about a fundamental choice about what's important in human living. That little underlying niggling feeling that was there in the opening illustration is now brought out with much more serious effects or implications. The meal that is unfolding reminds us of another meal that Luke tells us about, a meal at which Martha is bustling around the house, efficiently making sure that the roast is cooking properly, that the servants are doing what they're supposed to do. And what is Mary doing? She's sitting at Jesus' feet, listening to what he is saying, and Martha, in that case, is none too happy. She complains to Jesus as Mary is sitting right there. On that occasion, Jesus says to Martha, "Martha, Martha, you're anxious. You're troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. And Mary has chosen the good part which will not be taken away from her." So cue this story. Here we are in John's gospel. And there are no words of exchange or exchange between Mary and Martha. We just have their actions, which are so emblematic of who they are. It says, Martha served. Yes, she would. Lazarus sat at the table. Why are men always just sitting around? I don't know, but they often are in the Gospels. And Mary, she's sitting at the feet of Jesus. The pouring of the pound of nard combines extravagance with just enough weirdness, right? Like the wiping of Jesus' feet with her hair. It's tinged with a kind of scandal. It feels like a scene, actually, straight out of a Robertson Davies novel, doesn't it? For those of you that have read Robertson Davies, just psychologically off-kilter. Psychologists do tell us that the most memorable moments in our lives are those that involve our sense of smell. The smallest whiff of a scent. You've probably been in this situation. You're in a room and you smell something and you're brought back to an incident early in your life. It takes us back to a specific moment in our childhood. I was wondering why that was, and I was looking it up this week. It's because smell is processed in the same part of the brain as emotion. The smell of a grilled Kraft Velveeta sandwich. Well, shouldn't be called cheese, right? It's cheese food. It's not real cheese. But, you know, if I smell that smell, I'm back to age 6. My legs are swinging under the table, and my mom's worrying over a pot of soup. Whenever the disciples would have smelt nard, they would have been back in this scene. The musky odor, both earthy and sweet, filling the entire house. And they would have also never forgotten what Judas said. Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii, which in our money, between $24,000 and $35,000? Why was this perfume not sold and the money given to the poor? Now John, he's got a bit of a beef with Judas that the other Gospels don't have. And he tries to throw us off the scent, pun intended, by telling us about Judas in a way that smacks of sour grapes. You know, like he jumped the gun and tell us everything about his character before the acts are done. But here's the thing. Whatever Judas ends up doing, and it's not good, we all know that, here the fact is that he's more practical and efficient than Martha, and it's not to his detriment. It's to his credit. For surely he's right, isn't he? Really, if we think about it. Most of us, if we're honest, and I certainly count myself in this camp, find ourselves more beholden, trapped even, to go back to my opening illustration, in ways of acting that are more like Martha's and hold on to attitudes which are much more like Judas's. But, and here's where the story draws us into this conflict, it's precisely these attitudes exhibited by Judas that Christ is inviting us today to repent of. Why? Because to put it bluntly, efficiency, utility, and pragmatism are a poison to our soul and have well nigh ruined the earth. But we protest, what about responsibility? What about using money wisely? What about our time, talent, and treasure? We've even got a hallowed word for all of that, right? Stewardship. Yes to stewardship. We're called to be stewards of the earth and of our possessions and of our time and all of that. But it's really a case of cart and horse here. Which is first? If we, like Judas, can, in the face of an act of passionate commitment, when beauty is filling the room, and yet question its utility and practicality, we will find that we're learning to ignore and suppress the most important thing of all, love. Love of God and love of neighbor. As the raison d'etre of humankind, the extravagant love that actually fuels a practicality and stewardship that does not oppress, but draws us forward into beauty and purpose. You see, the most efficient societies that have ever existed, Leninist and Maoist communism, and globally market-driven capitalism, have either killed tens of millions of people in the name of efficiency and practicality, or rape the earth to such a degree that we're going to find it a miracle if we ever recover. Economics and politics that forgets the primacy of the love of God, born of gratefulness, traps us in patterns of living that rob us of our human distinctiveness. Just as a personal note and as a personal example, I have, in the name of efficiency, walked right past a homeless person in order that I might do the job that encourages all of us not to walk right past homeless people. Right? It's not passionate commitment, even extravagant commitment, that should scare us. It's cold-hearted efficiency. What Lent asks us to consider, what this story asks us to wrestle with, is that an ordinary life becomes disordered if it is not founded on a great love. The flip side is also true. Human life becomes extraordinary, even if it looks very ordinary, if it is founded with such a love in the mix. This one thing I do, Paul says in our second reading, I consider everything rubbish in comparison to knowing Christ. Does this mean that everything else we enjoy is rubbish? No. Paul's exaggeration is meant to order our lives, not after the manner of law or practicality, but by and for love. And then, as our psalm for today says, you know, if we do it with our whole heart, then the law becomes something that really means something. Then it does not oppress, but frees. When we do this, then we will find that the tasks we need to do will not ignore the actual people involved in them. Then we will find that our service is not about building our own egos, but truly for others. And then we will begin to treat the poor, not as a project to be fixed, but as extensions of Christ himself, people with whom we share the mystery of life and love. Amen.